newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now, you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new...
The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis where we get into some of the decision-making that goes on in American newsrooms and some of the tough challenges that lie ahead in journalism with some veteran journalists. I'm Rex Smith from the Upstate American, formerly editor of the Times Union, and I'm here with my colleagues, Judy Patrick and Barbara Lombardo and Ian Pickus. So let's see here. Judy Patrick, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette of Schenectady and vice president of the New York Press Association for a while. What is it you want to deal with here today?
You know, this week I learned about an economic development corp down in Alabama that's working to save a local newspaper. This is a totally new approach, and I was stunned.
What a concept. Let's talk about that. Barbara Lombardo, formerly executive editor of the Saratogian and the Record of Troy. What's on your mind today?
In addition to what Judy brought up, I'm hoping we can talk about the independent journalist who was just born. He was actually the TV reporter and news anchor who got fired from his job after more than 25 years.
Ah,
for
Terry
Moran. His opinion.
Yes, he expressed his opinion online and therefore lost his job. Interesting issue. Yeah, okay, that's a good topic. Ian Pickus, the news director of Northeast Public Radio. Sir, our host here, actually. What do you want to talk about?
I'm wondering if Edward R. Murrow on the stage is just comfort food for these difficult times.
Apropos the CNN broadcast of the now just closed Broadway hit Good Night and Good Luck about Edward R. Murrow and Fred Friendly. Cool. Good topics all. By the way, before we get to topics, we should note that we always appreciate hearing from listeners. And we did hear from two listeners this week. This is very interesting. Michael writes in to say, the June 6th show was the best I've heard in years. You finally broke the usual gloom and doom format, et cetera, et cetera. And Stephen writes in to say, the absolute worst segment ever. What the hell were you thinking?
We've been down these roads before, haven't we?
Haven't we?
Any editor has gotten those kind of calls the same story.
And, you know, this was a different kind of a show, though, right?
Yes, it was a show where we brought in Mitra Kalita, a formerly managing editor of the LA Times, who is now doing independent, I guess, niche targeted journalism based in New York City. And Michael here says that Mitra was a breath of life. She saw problems and was willing to do a lot more than cry in her beer.
We have beer on the show?
Hey. The beer?
What the hell? I tell you. He says our usual format, the gloom and doom format in which grizzled newspaper veterans, that would be us people, complain about how their students, the financial crisis, newspapers, the overall decline in journalism standards. And Michael also writes about Terry Moran. There's a lot here. We'll do it here. So we'll get back to this. Thank you for sending your messages. media@wamc.org is how we get them. And we appreciate them. We even appreciate Stephen telling us about what a terrible program it was.
Well, I like the idea of having people who are in journalism in one way, shape, or form in different fields and coming from different perspectives. And I think it can enhance the program if we have conversations with those people. And I would like to hear from more of the listeners of who would they like to hear from, what topics they would like to hear.
Actually, that would be great. We'd love to hear that. Well, my interest is piqued by a story from Columbia Journalism Review about the notion that some small-town newspapers are dying, not necessarily because of the digital revolution, not because they're being squashed by Google, but because no one wants to run them. It's really hard to run a small-town newspaper. And the fact is, a lot of folks, as they're getting older, don't have heirs, and they're just having to close down. But it provoked for me memories of a guy named Howard Ziff, who in the 1980s launched the journalism program at UMass Amherst. Howard Ziff died a dozen years ago. But he had this concept of the two different worlds of journalism, which he defined as the provincial journalism and cosmopolitan journalism. Two different things, he said. They're not the same. That provincial journalism was actually taking responsibility for your community, your province. Your moral obligation was to be subjective and compassionate, be involved with your community as a local journalist. And the cosmopolitan journalism was the stuff that worries about ethics and principles and responsibilities. And he was lamenting this transition of the smaller community-based newspapers from the provincial to the cosmopolitan. And you know what is interesting? I've thought about that often because I used to run a very small newsroom. I was the editor of a tiny newspaper in northwestern Indiana, and then I became the editor of The Record in Troy. And I've seen how sometimes small newspapers do kind of get carried away with the cosmopolitan ethos and lose track of the provincial value. Because people really want to know what's going on in their community, right?
First of all, can I say that this is a real thing? I have heard from many owners of newspapers who are also the publishers and also the editors. And these people work 7 days a week. They do everything from covering volleyball meets to pasting up the paper to delivering the bundles. I mean, it is nonstop work, but they love it. But as they get older, their children have seen what their parents' lives have been, and they do not want to take it on. And finding someone to buy these papers is incredibly difficult. That's why one of the things we're seeing around the country is a consolidation of papers, that, you know, four or five papers will be owned by one company, and they'll try to find some economies of scale to take some of the burden off. So that's a real thing. I mean, running a small local newspaper is very, very difficult, very time consuming. You have to be all in. It's not a 9-to-5 job. It's not something you can just take a vacation from. These guys don't take vacations typically. I'm one of those provincial journalists, but I think provincial journalism does rely on ethics. When you run a small newspaper, oftentimes you get the sense that, you know, you want to do the Pulitzer Prize winning stories. But, you know, the grants out there are for those Pulitzer Prize winning stories, you know, the big investigative pieces. But what your readers want are the school lunch menus, the obituaries, the engagements, the ball scores, the when the parade starts. Those are real community builders. They are difficult to do, and you really have to be out there in the community, working the streets, working your contacts. Again, it's terribly important. It's terribly hard work, but it leads to all sorts of civic engagement and good things for us in terms of our citizenry, in terms of how we function as a community. So these are real problems. They tend to get overlooked because we focus on, you know, the big, larger journalism issues. But, you know, writing that small story about the water system is equally important to those people who drink that water.
It's strictly a labor of love. Love for journalism, love for serving the community. And if you're at a small town newspaper, you're going to err on the side of being a booster for the community. But you're right, Judy, when you say you can be both cosmopolitan in the sense that you do have ethics. You do have to not be run by the head of the Chamber of Commerce or Downtown Business Association. You have to be able to tell stories that might get local people mad.
But you have to go to the chamber lunch.
Yes. So it makes it hard. And they're not necessarily in attractive places to live. They're wonderful places for the people who grew up there. But who's going to not only want this very demanding position and also have to live in that community if they weren't raised there?
I would also question whether it's true that audiences want this local news. I mean, they often say that they want this local news.
For free. But
exactly. You know, there's so much sort of consternation with national cable news and talking heads and talking past each other and Musk is down and Trump is up and all that kind of coverage, except that is what gets the bulk of the attention. And so unless there is a sustainable model in place or some sort of stream to keep that going, people know that they're supposed to say, you know, I want my side of asparagus, but they're usually not eating that first.
Yeah. Yeah. It is hard. But I do recall community leaders in a small town when I was at the Times Union approaching us to try to get us to come in and start covering their community because they didn't like what their local newspaper was doing. And I think that that might have had something to do with the fact that the reporters were not necessarily experienced in investigative reporting, but they were trying to bring that mindset to this local community that just wanted to have the lunch menus and wanted to have what was going on in the community. And I understand the community wants that. Sometimes I do think that we get so determined to exercise our oversight role that we fail in our storytelling role. And this sounds like a terrible thing to say, but you know, if you bring objectivity and disinterestedness, let's say that word, disinterestedness does not really have a place in small town journalism. Fairness does, but you don't want to be cold about your community. You want to be engaged in it. When I was at this little paper in Indiana, one of my assignments in the summertime was to take the pictures of every Little League team. And we put each team, there were 16 of them in that little community, because every little boy at the time, it was only boys in those days, played Little League. And every one of them got on the front page. And the grand champion and reserve champion pig at the county fair got on the front page. These are important stories in the local community, much more so than what I was trying to do about, well, what's happening with the economic development in our little city.
But now there might be other ways to get that information. So the Little League group itself can be posting team pictures if they choose to do that. Saratoga is not a tiny town, but it's a small town, and there's development going on my street. And as a citizen, I want to know what's happening with that project. And if the local newspapers are not covering that, then I have to do it the hard way. I talk to my neighbors, and we are reading the planning board minutes, and we're watching the video that the city provides of the meetings and appearing at the meetings. But to find one source of what's happening with that project, what happened at last night's design review board meeting, that it's difficult to know what's going on in your town.
Right. And I think Facebook or social media is a poor substitute for the professionalism that happens when we curate a story or we curate the news. It gives it a level of credibility that you don't get on social media. If there's a fire in your town or a murder or a school vote, there's nothing like a real reporter who knows the questions to ask. We don't want just press releases from the school superintendent about what's going to happen with the school budget. We want someone who's covered that before, who knows to ask the questions, because again, if we're just going to be a press release society, we are going to be ill-informed, because press releases never go far enough.
So you can hope that these community newspapers will have people who are engaged in the community, but also independent enough to be fair judges. I mean, I think that was the case in the newspaper in Kansas, The Mirror, where the police raided the home of the elderly publisher, or actually the mother of the publisher. She died of a heart attack the next day. You know, this is quite a remarkable story, but that was an example of a community newspaper doing its job and getting squelched by the powers that be as a result. But these people are still at it. They're still living in the community, still trying to do that. And I think that's kind of what you hope for. The problem is that so many of these small papers have been absorbed by chains where reporters join the teams in order to get ahead. I'll go to work for this chain, and if I work for this little paper, then I can then work for that bigger paper, and then that bigger
paper.
Be
a cosmopolitan.
And you become a cosmopolitan.
But that's okay. You need to get started somewhere, and the pay is going to be low, and the location may not be your first choice, but you love the business, you love the idea of journalism, so that's part of the nature of the business as you start there. Sure, it's a downside for the community because you don't get the institutional knowledge.
Well, what about this issue that Judy raised about this economic development agency? The Tuskegee News is the weekly paper serving a city of about 8,700 people, Tuskegee, Alabama, and now the economic development arm of the county has acquired the Tuskegee News because nobody else is buying it.
Man, I saw this story and, you know, my first reaction was bad, 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 bad. This is not good. This is not good. We're just going to get press release news. Again, about probably in the 10th paragraph, they said that they were going to separate themselves from the actual operation of the newspaper so it would have some independence. So I said,
oh, sort of like what Jeff Bezos said about the Washington Post. Gotcha, gotcha.
Yeah.
You know, that's the gloom and doom side of you, Barb. I'm looking at the positive here. I've never seen anything like this. And, you know, economic development, man, clearly it's a business. Clearly this is something in need of a little bit of support. So bravo to them in Alabama for thinking outside the box.
And they've hired a Auburn University graduate who plans to launch a fully digital version of the paper within 100 days. And I think that will help to keep it alive. You can't be just print only, even if you're a little community paper. I don't think these days.
100 days?
Yeah.
What could possibly happen in 100 days? I'm optimistic about it, actually. And I was nervous because it's a local business entity, but I want to believe that it means that they care enough about having media in their community, covering their community.
And, it, you know, just to harken back to the earlier conversation, you know, you can be an important civic institution without being a homer. And I think everyone's going to have to find what that line is.
Yeah, that's really exactly right. it doesn't need the full-throated support of every political decision, which is what the local politicians want for an institution to be part of the community. If you have thoughts on this, folks, media@wamc.org is how you can share your thoughts. But I do want to get to show business, and that would be that wonderful Broadway play, Good Night and Good Luck. Ian, you wanted to raise the fact that CNN had aired that the next to the last night that it was open on Broadway and then did a panel discussion.
And I hadn't seen Good Night and Good Luck since the movie was new 20 years ago, which George Clooney also directed and now is playing the lead role. So I was excited for it, you know, as somebody who grew up and was kind of trained to revere Murrow. And, you know, I like Alana Glazer as much as the next person. But I found myself getting more and more depressed while watching it, because I think although the issues were so timely, obviously, you've got power, you've got commerce, and you have pressure from the government, and you have advertisers to worry about. None of the issues have changed, except I don't know that as a 2025 American society that anybody is capable of shame. And also, Murrow was able to command the screen to the point where people could, with an open mind, change their mind about an issue. And I think today, you know, one, there's not just three networks, but there would be a concerted effort to say, well, Murrow is fake news and he's clearly just got it in for Joe McCarthy. And I think that just made me sadder and sadder while watching it, because it felt like a relic of a bygone era in journalism where a really well-crafted report using the public official statements to demonstrate their hypocrisy, it just wouldn't have that effect anymore. It's not possible.
Yes, I agree. I wonder what sort of a figure could even emerge in America anymore, given the multiplicity of voices in the media and the stark divisions in American society about who believes what. I just can't imagine that there would be anybody with influence similar to what Edward R. Murrow had.
Except maybe Joe Rogan convincing you, you know, not to take XYZ vaccine after a 3-hour, you know, disquisition. That's like the closest thing we have, I think.
It is kind of depressing.
I was fortunate enough to see the show on Broadway, and I was very excited that they were putting it on CNN so that more people can see it at their homes. And I'm hopeful that there will be some personality, using Joe Rogan as an example. It's the force of the president's personality that I think has contributed greatly to where we are today, that people will turn to him and believe in him. And there just doesn't seem to be at the moment that type of person who, I think the cream would rise to the top if there was somebody that dynamic.
So I'm optimistic that something will emerge, because if you remember back in the 20s and 30s, there were newspaper columnists that could do that. And then as the television industry or the broadcast industry developed, then you saw the Murrows, the Walter Cronkite emerge. And so I think what will happen is you're going to see somebody on social media. It's going to happen. I mean, is it the fact that there are so many sources of information that makes it impossible? We thought that maybe just the single stream is what made Murrow effective. I just have to hope that somebody's going to be able to break through, because I am an optimistic person. It's not just gloom and doom here.
There you go.
It's got to happen.
It's amazing. You know, I was a student of Fred Friendly, who was the producer. That was actually Fred Friendly was the role that originally in the movie that George Clooney played. Which was odd, by the way, because Fred Friendly was not an attractive fellow, and George Clooney might be, you know, the best-looking guy in showbiz. So it's much better to have him playing Murrow. But the fact is, Friendly, who was the producer behind Murrow, was the push. He was the guy who kept saying, we can do this, we can do this. It is significant to note, though, that Fred Friendly became the president of CBS News and quit in protest when CBS News crumbled in the face of opposition in the mid-60s, CBS News refused to air the hearings that Senator Fulbright was leading on the Vietnam War and instead aired reruns of I Love Lucy, a 7th rerun of that episode. And Friendly resigned in protest, became a professor, which is how I became one of his students. And I think it is interesting that even the much vaunted CBS News, the home of Edward R. Murrow, crumbled just a few years after that broadcast that is now depicted in Good Night and Good Luck. All institutions have, I guess, their breaking point, which I guess brings us to the issue that, Barbara, you wanted to talk about involving ABC News, which has now fired correspondent Terry Moran.
Yeah, I think the short part of our conversation could probably be, should he have been fired? Because I think we're all going to say yes. So what Terry Moran did was tweet about the hateful sharpness of Stephen Miller.
And Donald Trump.
And Donald Trump.
World-class
and to
hater.
The objective observer, I don't think what he said could be successfully debated. But it's not his place as a representative of the media, as a reporter and a news anchor for a respected journalism entity. He should not be expressing his opinion in that way. So I think it needed to cost him his job. And what I'm interested in now is now he's joining Rex on Substack.
So we have another. That's how people think of it, I'm sure. Yeah.
So we have another
Beltway American.
We have another independent journalist, but we also have lost a journalist. And if you become an independent journalist, what kind of access do you get? And getting an audience, how does that work?
Right. It's certainly not going to be the same for him, or as even Tucker Carlson has found out. Once you lose the platform that is a big platform like Fox News, or in the case of Terry Moran, ABC, it's not going to be the same.
Yeah. Did any of you think that his punishment was too severe?
It definitely read like somebody whose contract was up, kind of burning the bridge. Although I do think if he had to take a lie detector, that Stephen Miller would probably agree with that analysis and embrace it. I mean, they're happy to have the dispute with ABC News, but it's almost a compliment to Stephen Miller's political style and his rise to power, honestly.
It was cringeworthy because the media has enough problems without providing on a silver platter. See how biased we are?
You know, my problem with this whole social media push for journalists to be on social media, develop a presence, is that oftentimes the organizations aren't giving the journalists enough guardrails. They're not telling them what they can and cannot do. What they're trying to do is encourage them to be out there and to be engaging, to be provocative. I think Terry Moran went over the line. But in general, I think every news organization needs a social media policy to give the reporters, the editors, the photojournalists some sense of what they can and what they cannot
do. But that's the thing. This wasn't reporting. This was like pure punditry, you know, sent off in 140 characters. And this is from somebody who was just a few weeks ago in a Oval Office interview with the president. I mean, he has things to report, presumably.
Yeah, it was really unnecessary. I think it is interesting that it was a tweet in the middle of the night. I think he probably would regret it in the morning. But it's untenable. You can't keep somebody in your employ if you're a network after that kind of thing. But it does, I think you're right, reinforce the sense that people have of whatever their own opponent in the media is, that's what they're like. You know, we just saw a new report today from the Pew Research Center based on 9,500 people surveyed showing that Republicans largely turn to Fox. More than half of the Republicans in this new study say they get their news from Fox. Less than a fifth of Democrats do. Also, Democrats have a wider variety of news sources. Republicans tend to really focus on Fox. And so you're naturally going to believe your source and disbelieve the others. And that's a really unfortunate development that goes to the point that you were making earlier, Ian, about how there is not any more a place people can get credible information that they will believe.
And with ABC, you know, the reporter clearly steps over the line and he's fired. With Fox, their lead Evening Star Sean Hannity has nightly phone calls on strategy with the president and has said for years things like, you know, Barack Obama and Nancy Pelosi hate America and faces no consequence whatsoever. So I think you're seeing the siloing just continue, and I don't see how that we can put it back together to have that, you know, 1950s or 60s CBS monoculture where we all can agree on some things.
Which is, I guess, why it takes us back to our local news conversation at the very beginning. The credibility that attaches to your local news outlets, to the places where you know the people who are there providing the news all the time, is of great value to you. Actually, I think that's one of the advantages that WAMC has, because people hear you, they know you, they come back to you all the time. You're actually a part of the community, which this recent fund drive demonstrates, right?
And it's been a tough one, no doubt about it. And as we speak, you know, this is everything we've been talking about in practice. Will people support having reporters in their backyard, or do they just want the latest headline out of the Capitol? And we're finding, you know, for many of them, WAMC remains a very important part of their news consumption, and we're hoping that we can just keep growing that.
Absolutely. And we're glad that you're here, folks. So that brings us to the end of another broadcast of the Of the Upstate American. Wouldn't that be great? Another broadcast of the Media Project, for which we are grateful that you tuned in. Every week we try to bring you some interesting analysis and thoughtful commentary on what's going on in the media, and we are appreciative of your presence here. Ian Pickus of WAMC, Barbara Lombardo, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. We are grateful to our producer, Dave Gustina. Mostly, though, we thank you for joining us on the Media Project and hope we'll see you again next week here on the Media Project.
Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the globe. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's only throat. She chopped him into fragments. She stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now newspapermen meet such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's aunt.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, WAMC News Director Ian Pickus, and Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian. You can listen to the Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
To get a living wage, they joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the globe. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy's an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.